Coming up next, longtime civil rights lawyer and president of the National Lawyers Guild, Michael Avery, spoke April 28th in Chicago at DePaul University. Here's what he had to say.
I want to start out talking a little bit about secret police. Secret police in every society that has had them have been an oppressive institution, an institution that takes on a life of its own and is not subject to any constitutional or democratic restraints. This was true of the Okhrana in Tsarist Russia. It was true of the NKVD shortly after the Russian Revolution. It was true of the KGB during the Stalinist period in the Soviet Union. It was true of the Stasi in East Germany. And it's certainly true of the CIA and the FBI today, to the extent that those agencies operate like secret police. Secrecy on the part of government is one of the hallmarks of a national security state. And there's no question that the United States today is now moving faster and faster into becoming a national security state rather than a constitutional democracy. The key elements of a constitutional democracy that are protected by the Bill of Rights are free speech, the right to be free from arrest and search unless the government has probable cause to believe that you're guilty of a crime, the particularity requirement of the Fourth Amendment that says when the government's going to conduct a search, it has to be looking for something in particular, not just conducting a fishing expedition to see what it might turn up, and judicial review of executive department action. And all of these key elements of the Bill of Rights are threatened by the various programs that the administration has put in place since September 11th. Along with adopting racial profiling as our national policy, in connection with rounding up and holding over 5,000 people of Arab or Muslim backgrounds after September 11th, along with running roughshod over the rights of ordinary Americans in a variety of respects, the construction of a surveillance industrial complex in this country that is far beyond what any previous dictatorship could have dreamed of establishing is truly one of the landmark achievements, if you will, of the Bush administration. So let's talk a little bit in that connection about the lawsuit that we filed against President Bush. And I can't tell you what a pleasure it is, by the way, to draft a complaint that's going to be filed in federal court that the first defendant is George W. Bush. There was some discussion among the lawyers when we drafted this thing about whether to sue Bush or just to sue the NSA, and my position was, are you out of your mind? We're going to put this guy right there. And if I could have served the papers in person, that would have been my first choice. What are the issues in this case? There are plenty of people in the room. I mean, this is a great room because there's such a range in this room of age among the people who are here. It's fantastic. This is a little deviation from what I planned to say at this point in the speech, but I want to tell you, just so you have an idea what's coming down the pike. I'm 61 years old. I'll be 62 in December, and I've spent my whole life as since I was an adult as a civil rights lawyer, and I've represented the Black Panthers, and I've represented the people involved in gay rights. And I've represented women's rights people, and I've done a lot of work in Puerto Rico on behalf of the independentistas. But I am a white, a male, a middle-class guy who was born in Chicago and grew up in Minneapolis, a Protestant, Ivy League education. I've never been a member, narrowly speaking, of any of the groups that I've represented in my life. But soon I'm going to be able to claim to be elderly. And then we are going to see a movement like this country has never seen before for seniors' rights. I'll tell you that. But going back to the lawsuit, there are plenty of people in the room who can remember, and even more who've read about the time during the Korean War when Harry Truman, as president, seized the steel mills in the United States. Because there was a threatened labor dispute that he believed would have disrupted the production of steel and interfered with the United States' ability to make weapons that could be used in the Korean War. And that case went to the United States Supreme Court on the question of whether or not the president had what constitutional lawyers would call implied power to seize these steel mills. Why implied power? Because there's nothing in the Constitution that says that the president has the right to seize private property, even for national security reasons. And so the question was there something in the Constitution that gave the president other powers from which we might imply that he has the power to seize the steel mills? And of course, the favorite candidate for this kind of implied power is always the president's authority as commander-in-chief of the armed forces. And that case went to the United States Supreme Court, and the United States Supreme Court said, no, he doesn't have that power. He doesn't have that power in part because Congress made it very clear when they were considering the Taft-Hartley Act, which passed in 1948, I believe, that they weren't going to give the president that power. There was an amendment on the floor that would have given the president that power, and it was rejected. And so the Supreme Court said if the president doesn't have the power under the Constitution, and Congress hasn't passed a law giving him the power, and Congress has made it clear that he doesn't have the power, then in a very famous opinion by Justice Jackson on the United States Supreme Court, he said the president's power is at its lowest ebb in that situation. The dispute about whether President Bush has the power to engage in electronic surveillance without a warrant is a dispute, at least so far as it's a constitutional law dispute, about how it fits into this framework that the court established in connection with Truman's seizure of the steel mills. And a little history at this point is important. In the 70s, President Nixon also asserted a power to engage in electronic surveillance without warrants. And he was surveilling people who were deemed to be, by him, domestic threats to national security. And that case went to the United States Supreme Court. It's called United States versus United States District Court. We usually call it the Keith case because the judge was Damon Keith, who still is a judge in Detroit, Michigan, federal judge in Detroit, Michigan. And that case was argued in the Supreme Court by Professor Arthur Kanoy from Rutgers Law School. Arthur Kanoy was and will always be one of the icons of the National Lawyers Guild, and that was a case in which the National Lawyers Guild, the National Lawyers Guild, was very much involved in that case. And the United States Supreme Court decided in the Keith case that President Nixon did not have the power, implied power, to conduct electronic surveillance without warrants of domestic so-called threats to national security. But that left open the question, actually, of what power the president might have if there were foreign threats to national security, foreign organizations. And the Supreme Court explicitly, in the Keith case, did not rule on that. Now, it just so happened that during this time, there was a committee meeting in the United States Senate, the Church Committee. And the Church Committee was considering evidence of the abuses of constitutional rights and civil liberties by the Nixon administration, specifically including illegal wiretapping and the infiltration of domestic political groups through undercover agents and spies and provocateurs. And the Church Committee, in a series of reports that run, if I'm not mistaken, 38 volumes in the Federal Register, documented an outrageous series of violations of rights by the Nixon administration. So in 1978, the Church Committee, having issued its report about illegal electronic surveillance and other illegal surveillance of domestic political groups, and this issue about foreign agents being left open in the Keith case, the Congress decided to act. And they passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which specifically allowed the president to engage in surveillance of foreign threats. At that time, they were mostly concerned about the Soviet Union, of foreign threats to our national security. But the law provided that the president had to get a warrant. And in order to make it as easy as possible to get these warrants, they set up a special court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Now, it's not a court in any ordinary sense. It doesn't meet in a courthouse. It meets on the sixth floor of the Justice Department in Washington, D.C. And the only lawyers who ever appear in front of it are government lawyers. Defense lawyers never appear in front of it. And as a matter of fact, if you ever have a case, and I had such a case, at one point I was representing some Armenian Americans who were accused of conspiring to blow up the Turkish consulate in Philadelphia. Case was tried in Los Angeles. There had been one of these foreign intelligence surveillance warrants in the case, even after they were arrested and even when they were being prosecuted. We didn't get to see what the government had relied on in order to secure that warrant. Only the judge looked at it. So they made it as easy as possible. The government didn't have to have probable cause to believe that people were committing a crime. They only had to have probable cause to believe that they were foreign agents. And as long as they had that, they could get a warrant to conduct electronic surveillance. Now, that was amended in later years so that it provide, and it was amended again after the Patriot Act, as a matter of fact. It was amended to provide that if the government was in a crisis situation and did not have time to go get a warrant before it was necessary to start listening to people planning some imminent threat against the United States, they could start listening first, even without a warrant, as long as they went and got a warrant within 72 hours. Three full days to go get the warrant after you start listening. And in this law, Congress said, this is the exclusive means by which the United States government can engage in electronic surveillance of foreign groups that allegedly pose a national security threat to the United States. And just to make the point even clearer, they said if any government officials do this any other way, it's a 5-year felony. That law only applies to government officials. If you and I did any national security wiretapping, we wouldn't be subject to that law. We'd be subject to a host of other criminal laws, but not that one. That one just applies to government officials. So one of the things that we claim in our case is that it's even much clearer now than it was in the Steele seizure case that Congress had said to the president, you can't do this unless you do it through the avenue that we've provided. The president has committed a felony under our law. Not once, but several times. He admits that he's authorized this program 40 times, and he's probably authorized it some more times since he made that admission. Each one of which, actually, each time they listen to somebody, it's a separate felony. He could be in prison not only for the rest of his own life, but for the rest of the lives of all the little shrubs that are going to come after him through his children and his grandchildren. That's how many felonies this man has committed. He should be impeached. There's no question about that. The President of the United States is not only a liar, he's a felon. And so we sued him. Now what's going to happen in this case? This is not going to be an easy case for us. Because the first thing the government's going to do, they probably did it today, because I think they had to file their papers by today, although I haven't seen any papers yet today. First thing they're going to do is come to court and say, you can't even hear this case. Because to talk about this program, we would have to reveal secret information. And that would compromise national security. And so you're going to have to throw the case out of court. That's going to be the government's argument, that secrecy requires that Americans not even have a chance to challenge the fact that their president is violating the law and violating the Constitution every time he conducts one of these electronic surveillances. Courts shouldn't even hear about it. So what are we seeing here? We're seeing violations of three of the four principles that I said were cardinal principles. Here is a search, because listening to somebody's conversation is a search. Here's a search without probable cause. Here's a violation of the particularity requirement, because they're just listening to everything they want to listen to instead of searching for something in particular. And there's no judicial review if the government wins this argument. Executive Department gets to do what it wants without judges getting involved. And what the government is currently arguing goes a step further than that, by the way. There's this doctrine of the unitary executive. I don't know how many of you have heard about this or read about this, or how many of the law students in the room have studied this in law school, but there's this doctrine that President Bush is promoting called the unitary executive. Those of us who are critical of what they're doing call it the imperial presidency. That's what Al Gore called it recently in a speech that he gave. What does it mean, the unitary executive? It's a doctrine that says the whole executive department is a single whole, and the president is the boss of the whole executive department. What that means is that there are no independent federal regulatory agencies. I mean, our country has relied for several years on the existence of independent federal regulatory agencies to monitor and regulate excesses not only on the part of government but on the part of the private sector. Under this doctrine, the president could fire anybody who works for the executive department. That's not, however, the principal problem with the doctrine. The principal problem with the doctrine is a doctrine called coordinate construction. It has been the case since 1803. The law students know what 1803 was. That's when Marbury versus Madison was decided in the United States Supreme Court. It has been the case since 1803 when John Marshall declared, "It is emphatically the role of the United States Supreme Court to declare what the law is." It has been the law that the Supreme Court has the responsibility of reviewing from a constitutional standpoint both what the legislature does and what the executive branch does. Judicial review. And really, the buck stops with the Supreme Court. Lately, the president, and not just President Bush, by the way, this goes back. Clinton was pushing this line. Papa Bush was pushing this line. Reagan was pushing this line, that each branch of the government, the judicial, the executive, and the legislature, has its own responsibility to interpret the Constitution. Well, in a certain sense, that's true. I mean, if you work for the government in any respect, you have to take an oath to support the Constitution of the United States. But they mean much more than that. They mean that the president makes his own decision about whether something is constitutional and is not bound by what the Supreme Court says about